Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Welcome to Holy Smokes Catholic Review, your weekly dose of good cigars and the good news. This podcast is brought to you by St. John Vianney Catholic Church in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Incensing the temple today, Father Scott Mansfield, pastor and former rock radio DJ, Tony Willamitis, the guy who knows everything, and Will Tapia, the guy who thinks he knows everything. Now, here's your host, Father Scott.
It is Holy Smokes Catholic Review. I am your host, Father Scott, along with Tony Willamitis.
Happy Easter, everybody.
Yeah, we continue to say Easter for,
all the way up until Pentecost.
That's right.
So it's the third. We just celebrated the third Sunday of Easter. Mm-hmm. Last week was Divine Mercy, and now we're in the third week of Easter. And how's your Easter going? Is it, is it celebratory? Is it festive?
That's festive and incredibly busy.
Yeah?
Yeah, well,
what's been going on, man?
Well, we had, last week we had confirmation. The Archbishop came.
Yeah.
And then
he had
a meeting with the staff, and then we went to dinner, and then we had the confirmation. And, of course, there was the confession of the kids, and then there was the rehearsal and all of that. And then this past Friday, we had the confirmation. I'm sorry, the...
Communion. First communion.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Communion, Friday was the sacrament of reconciliation.
For all the First Communion kids who are getting ready.
Yeah, and then Saturday was the rehearsal, and then Sunday, yesterday, was
That's a
the
lot.
Actual... So there's that going on, and weddings, and then the occasional funeral, and then, just stuff going on here, there, and everywhere that is making it very difficult for me to play golf.
Man.
Okay.
Get in the way.
And then this Thursday, huge day, we're having the Heart of St. John Vianney. We're going to talk about this a little bit more in depth in a little bit. It's coming on Thursday. The heart it's a traveling heart. It's the actual heart, but it's traveling.
That made it sound like he had two hearts, for traveling and one actual.
Yeah, like an overnight bag kind of thing. Yeah,
right.
But no, it's the actual heart.
The actual heart of St. John Vianney.
Courtesy of the Knights of Columbus.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What a cool thing. I wonder what spawned this tour. Because it seems very timely. We mentioned this before. Mm-hmm. Very timely tour of the Heart of St. John Vianney, which is, a little strange. And you talked to us a little bit about, you talked a little bit about this in your homily this weekend. It's a little bit of a strange custom if you think about it. If you're not Catholic, you didn't grow up with this, and you're not tied into these Catholic concepts of, let's say, the goodness of the body and why we venerate relics and so forth. But they actually took the heart of St. John Vianney out of his body, which I believe still remains incorrupt. His heart is incorrupt and his body is incorrupt. That's very mystical.
And I believe, I'm not sure where his body is. I think it's in
Ars, France. Yeah, I think.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
I've not been to Ars.
No?
I've never been to France.
Oh, you need to go. If you're the pastor of St. John Vianney.
I know.
And you're going to build a church in his name.
I've been to Italy so many times. I've been to Croatia.
Right.
I've been to Germany several times. I've not been to France.
Yeah.
He's
the patron saint of parish priests.
Mm-hmm.
So an important figure for most of the priests that we know. And we're going to get to have his actual heart visit our parish, which seems pretty epic and almost understated, because in the life of our parish, we're young. We're newly incorporated, a few years ago, and then now we're looking to raise funds in the next couple of years to build a church. And we pray about it every weekend, and we mention it every podcast, and you know, it just seems pretty, how do you say, providential, right? And mm-hmm. now, of course, the heart is going to make stops. It has already made stops all over the country, and is going to make stops also in at the Immaculate Conception Church in Albuquerque downtown. But then, of course, definitely coming to our place before it goes to the cathedral in Santa Fe. So,
and then it's on its way to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and then back to Denver.
Wow. He's really making tracks, the St. John Vianney guy.
But it's interesting. I think today, he's actually going from New Jersey all the way to Phoenix.
That's crazy.
And then Phoenix to Gilbert, and then to, I think, Gallup. No, I'm sorry. Las Cruces, then down to El Paso.
Well, now they have to be, the way they transport this must be by airplane. They couldn't make that many dynamic stops without it being by airplane, I'm assuming.
Well, I would think that.
So my question is, whether it's by car or by airplane, how do they, I'm curious to see what kind of container they place the relic and the reliquary inside.
And how do you get that past, you know, TSA? They're going to wonder, what is this?
Exactly. How do you explain this to
the human heart? This looks like a heart. It is. And it's very old.
That would be very curious what kind of documents are necessary.
Well, I'm sure they prearrange with the TSA.
Yeah, I'm guessing.
The authorities probably know what's going on, I would think, you know. They probably have a special pass.
Right.
But my question is, okay, so obviously when it comes from New Jersey and goes to Phoenix, you got to fly it. But if it's going from Phoenix to Las Cruces, New Mexico, they probably just transport it by vehicle, right?
Yeah.
Car, wouldn't you think? Because that's a short distance. And then El Paso up to here is only 3.5 hours.
Right.
So that's nothing. I don't imagine you put on a plane for that. Just
no. Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you get it.
Well, with the networking of the Knights of Columbus. I mean,
sure. They're pretty well established all over the country. You know what would be cool is to be the guy responsible for said relic. I think that would be a pretty... pretty big honor.
Yeah.
That would be pretty phenomenal to have as you travel around the country.
Right.
With this incredible relic. Well, all the same, it's going to be quite a blessing to have the heart come, even if it's just for 3 hours from 2 to 5 in the afternoon there at our parish. Mm-hmm. And it'll be available for veneration starting right at 2:00. We'll cue everyone up and open the doors and then allow them to come down one side of the church and pass the relic. People have been asking, are you going to be able to touch the reliquary? Are you going to be able to touch items to the reliquary? We're not really certain about that, but certainly you'll be able to get close. And no doubt if you brought something, I'm sure that you wanted to touch to the reliquary, there'll be ushers or stewards or Knights of Columbus there that could do that for you.
Honestly, I don't know what they're going to allow.
Not really sure. Yeah.
But I made a point.
Worth a shot.
Oh, yeah. And it's all I'm very excited about this. And I've been telling everybody about it. I remember this was has to be over 20 years now that the relics of Teresa of Lisieux were brought to Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. And I was a seminarian and not expecting, you know, I was expecting to walk right in. And when I got there, there was a line 4 blocks long in downtown Albuquerque.
Wow. So that's phenomenal. Well, I hope that the word has gotten out enough. And if you're listening to this podcast before Thursday and you go to a parish other than St. John Vianney, make sure you spread the word to all your Catholic friends and family and parishioners and so forth, just so they know that the opportunity is there.
Right.
So it's middle of the day at Immaculate Conception Church and then in the afternoon at our place from 2 to 5. Now, question, and this might be more suited for our other podcast, the Catholic Beef, which is an apologetics podcast that comes out in cooperation with this one. But what's your take, Father? How do you explain to people who encounter this maybe for the first time? Why does the church venerate body parts of saints? And what does it say about what the church believes about the body? You know?
Okay, well, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And look, the body, you know, the Gnostics treated the body as something that was disposable. It was the spirit that mattered for them, right? The body is of no avail. And our Lord did say that. Didn't he say that at some point? The body is of no avail, right? But that's taken out of context oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
So the body, obviously, our flesh is important. It was created by God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we're a body-soul composite. We're not a detached spirit or a human person is not or the body is not just some container to hold the soul. And when the person dies, the soul is set free. And the fact that God created us to have bodies tells us everything we need to know. Okay. So look, angels are spirits, you know, dogs are dogs and they have bodies and so on. They don't have rational souls like we have. We have rational soul and body. We're a body soul composite. And the fact that not only that, that Jesus himself, who is God, took on our nature and took on our flesh, tells us a lot about the importance of the flesh. And the fact that when Jesus Christ rose from the dead, he didn't arise from the dead and appear as a ghost or this disembodied spirit. He rose in the flesh and said, look at my hands and my feet. Doesn't that tell us about all we need to know about the importance and the dignity of our bodies? Just in that alone, right? Okay, so our flesh, our souls, our flesh too, it's all redeemed, okay? And when we die on the last day, we're going to rise body and soul into the glory of the Lord, not just, you know, disembodied spirits.
Right.
So our flesh is important, and this is why the church has rules concerning, you know, burial and things like, you know, the scattering of ashes and things like that. You know, there's rules and regulations because we want to remember the dignity of the body, which, by the way, is God given. It's God given, right?
Right. So it must be, speaking of which, that's one of the questions I get when I talk about relics or have talked about relics. Someone will ask, then how come if it's okay to separate, let's say, a finger bone or a heart from the body of a saint that's been interred, why is it not okay to, say, take some of the ashes from, you know, my great-great uncle Jim who died and then, and you know, put some of them at this house or some of them at that house? Like, I'm guessing that the basic answer there is that it's a special privilege of the church in order to, because it's, because the effort here is to, sanctify the church with the model, you know, with the propagation of these models that we call saints.
Right. Now, well, let's get back to that in a minute, but let's touch on you know, the veneration of saints or holy people or their body parts goes all the way back to the earliest days of the church.
Yeah.
You know, so look, I brought it up yesterday in the sermon about how, you know, the Jews would collect blood, spilt blood. They would mop it up and save it because for them, blood is sacred. And, you know, because blood it is that gives life.
Right.
Without blood, there is no life. So Mel Gibson, you know, in the film The Passion, brought this out in a big way in the scene after the scourging at the pillar, how Mary, the two Marys, Mary of Magdala and the Blessed Mother Mary, you know, they receive the linens from the wife of Pilate and they mop up Jesus's blood, right? So in the earliest days of Christianity, when a holy person would die and they were buried, the other holy people or the members of that church community would come and venerate, and they would keep vigil and they would pray, and they would pray to that holy person, asking that holy person for that person's intercession, believing that holy person. And by holy person, we mean saint. Okay. Because saint comes from the word sanctify or, you know, sanctus, right?
Yeah.
It was a practice of the early church to go to the tomb where the person's body was buried and venerate and pray and keep vigil and pay respect and all of that, right? It's why we have cemeteries today. You know, places of honor where we can go and honor the dead and pray.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. No doubt. And it's all testament, I think, like you said, that which is an anti-Gnostic idea that that we believe that the body is good, and it's through the body that we experience our, we've talked about this before in the podcast, it's through our bodies, our created, through our created world that we experience grace and communication with God. Right. And so I think about, you know, we kind of do a relic thing. A lot of times in our regular lives with people who have died, we get little knickknacks or books or prayer books, or I have my dad's umbrella that he used to carry with him every day to work, you know, in this car. And so we as humans are very much attached to this tangible reality of relics and relic keeping.
Look to your left on that. See that Okay, see, that's my dad's lucky coin. He carried that with him wherever he went.
Mm-hmm.
I still have it.
And that would be, let's say, if he is a saint in heaven, then this would be considered a second class relic.
Because and then my mother, yeah, and then those are see on the wall there. There's rosary beads.
Mm-hmm.
Little rosary beads. Those were my mother's, and she has she's passed away now, but very interesting story about those rosary beads.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you real quick. So, my mother and dad, my whole family lived in Japan after the war, Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the only one who did not live in Japan. So in any case, my mom went shopping. And I forget the town. Fukushima maybe was the town. It was an Air Force base near there, I think, maybe. I could be wrong, but a little village or a city. Well, fairly good-sized, town.
Yeah.
And so my mom went to shopping, and she told me, and she took a break. She sat, there was a park, and she sat in a park. Now, this is in Japan in 1954, I'm thinking, or 55?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, or 56? She's in Japan. She takes a break. She's sitting on a bench. A little girl, Mexican girl, dressed in Mexican garb, okay, with the bright colors and the shoes, typical Mexican dress. Cultural dress, comes up to my mom, hands her those rosary beads, and walked away.
Interesting.
Isn't that wild?
Wow.
So my mom told me the story. I'm like, Mother, do you realize that maybe the Blessed Mother gave this to Our Lady of Guadalupe? Who knows, right?
Right. So, wow.
Isn't that cool?
Phenomenal.
That's an awesome story.
What a very cool story.
So I've never let those out of my sight, those beads.
Well, they serve as relics, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And then so we do this, very naturally in other parts of our lives. And then
We
don't realize that it's connected to what we do as the church.
And that's not a Catholic thing. It's an everybody thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you don't have to be Catholic to have that kind of as part of your nature. Now, we, of course, it's taken to a little bit of an extra degree. And this is very much coming from former cultures, former times. We don't think of it so much anymore, I think, as in America, in modern times. Well, first of all, because the influence of Protestantism in our culture, in America, right? In our spiritual and religious culture. And then I think the other reason we don't do it is because we're also influenced by, I guess we should also be attached to Protestantism probably, but old British ways, right? British, manners and whatnot. Like the whole reason, for instance, that when you're in America, you tend to queue up for in your lines to, at a ticket window or whatever. When you go to Europe, some parts of Europe, like Italy and the Mediterranean areas, they don't queue up. They just bombard whatever it is, whatever door their ticket window they're going for, right? Like, that's just not a thing. So we have different, sensitivities here. I think that comes a little bit from our British background and also our Protestant background as a country, but it seems to be more natural and in touch with human reality and nature that we do this thing called relics. And of course, like you said, Father, also it's biblical. There's that great story of people being healed by the very shadow of St. Peter, let alone someone had gone and I think...
that was the woman who...
The handkerchief? Peter, they touched the handkerchief to Peter and then the handkerchief was taken and then it healed someone.
Well, and there was
family.
The woman with the hemorrhage who reached up and touched the Lord's garment.
Yeah, not to mention. Yeah, absolutely. So all these things they're all pointing in the direction of incarnational, realities and grace. And this is why we do it. And so we're looking forward to it.
Did we answer the third objection that you had? What was that? Did we answer
why
that?
Why do we allow saints to be, parceled out, but you're not allowed to parcel out
all right.
your
well,
family members?
That's it. I don't know. I just remember sitting in the backyard once with another priest and a friend of mine who's just lay guy asked that question. Why is the church, they won't allow me to have my ashes scattered, but the saints and then my friend who's the priest said, I tell you what, you want to be divided up, then become a saint.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know. I'd have to really, do some research on that, but.
Short of it. Yeah. Special circumstances, I'm guessing.
But it's not like scattering ashes. I mean, there's just tiny little fragments of bone usually skimmed off.
Well, and not only that, but the original internment of any saint, presumably was an actual Christian burial.
Correct, yeah.
Right, the original, as opposed to, say, those people who say, well, I want the original interment to not be an interment at all. I want it to be taking, first of all, cremation, and then I want to take and separate the ashes. So the original interment of any saint is going to be an actual Christian burial, full body or however.
Right.
And then, which how do you say, protects the dignity of the human body and what we understand it to be as sacred. And then after the fact, then when the church declares the person saint, then they go back and, you know, then they're taking various relics off the person.
Right. Now, the reason we allow cremation is that cremation simply speeds up a process that's going to happen naturally. Mm-hmm. But my question is, if you cremate a person who is meant to be incorrupt,
Interesting. Right. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Bewares, right?
Yeah.
Bewares.
Yeah, I'm gonna just be buried one of these days.
In under what green? Under what hole? What green? On what golf course?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The little headstone.
Yeah, right.
It'll be the Father Scott Mansfield Memorial Hole.
Right.
You know, hole number 14 at Santa Ana. Right.
Yeah. All right, so Thursday once again at St. John Vianney, all right, the heart 2 to 5.
Right.
For the time of arrival.
Very cool. Okay. So now, as part of our festivities, I'm sure, for any one of us, at least in this room, and maybe even listening, with the Easter season comes extra cigars to be smoked.
That's right.
And Father, you were asking me off the air if I had smoked anything lately. You know, honestly, I've not been smoking near as many as I had been maybe before Lent, but I did pick up again a cigar that I enjoyed before, and it was a little Macanudo Court, C-O-U-R-T. And what's great about that little cigar is that it's maybe a half an hour smoke. I find it pleasant from beginning to end. It has a nice medium leather flavor about halfway through the cigar. It doesn't take much. It's, you know, a nice addition to any beverage you might have. And I was actually smoking my Macanudo Court for the second time, this time after, let's see, this was either, I think it might have been before, after snacks, before the meal on race day, on the Kentucky Derby race day, which itself was an eventful thing. Did you see it by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, the foul and everything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, unless you know horse racing, you wouldn't know that you can't do that kind of stuff. But it makes sense to my mind. It's very logical.
Oh yeah,
it makes sense that there were rules against what the jockey did with that horse and the number one horse at the time, and then makes sense as to why the jockey might have been motivated to do something silly like that. Although it didn't seem like he needed to, you know, it's what happens when we fear, you know, where we fear we're not good enough. Maybe, maybe he was afraid his horse wouldn't win the race. And so he played a little foul and then he paid for it, you know, which I thought was interesting. This is all very tangential to the cigar review, but what I thought was very interesting about it is that the jockey who was in error didn't seem to protest the fact that they found him in error. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was noble. Because it seemed that if he had, in fact, caused the foul, then the most noble thing for him to do would be just be kind of like admit it by his silence.
Right.
You know, without protesting. Like sometimes you see, for instance, like the classic example I can think of is soccer players maybe who take a dive and it's a thing, you know, it's a thing and it happens and they protest, right? They protest that they've gotten hurt or something. It's bro.
Oh, come on. Have you seen them get hurt?
And you took a dive.
Yeah, they fall down and it's like, oh, and then they're rolling around and screaming and crying. Are you kidding me?
I mean, it's all an act, bro. Come on.
It's such an act.
Just be honest. You know what I mean? Like, okay, you tried to take the dive and then they didn't find it. So then just let it go. Move on.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what the jockey did. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, good for the, I thought they should have ran the race over again, either with or without the fouling jockey.
Yeah. By the way, you just mentioned soccer. I want to bring back soccer here in a second because we have this team, I guess, here locally.
Yeah, United.
Yeah, yeah.
Mexico United.
Let's talk about them because
they just started up this year.
They're getting like sold out crowds.
It's unbelievable. They have twice as many people coming to their matches as do the Isotopes for their baseball games.
They got like 14, 15, 16,000 people.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah, well, and we talked about this. In fact, we talked about this at my Kentucky Derby race party. It's talked about how phenomenal the crowd draw is on it, which makes sense. I mean, like, soccer is a very native sport here.
I guess. I find it so boring.
Well,
I'd rather watch bowling.
Yeah.
I like watching golf because I'm
golf.
A golfer.
Yeah. Now, see, this is the irony of it all.
Yeah.
You actually find golf interesting and not
because
boring.
Because I'm a golfer.
Yeah. That's it. I think there's so many young people that have grown up through soccer here that it's become a thing, you know?
Yeah. Huge crowds. Where do they play anyway?
They play at the Isotopes. I think they play at the Isotopes Park. Is that possible?
Really?
I think so. I think they might convert the field and everything for their play. But you know, it's time immemorial. It's the simplest sport you can put together.
Yeah,
two teams, one ball.
Yeah,
you know.
No, but then the thing with the free kick and all of that just ruins it. I'm like, oh please.
Well, there's all the rules and stuff you have to play by. But
bugs. Okay, so the Friday night, Rob House said, hey, come on over, smoke a cigar. So he turned me on to the Aging Room Pura Cepa, C-E-P-A, I'm guessing.
Yeah. You know what? I can't remember if I smoked that one or not.
I don't remember, but
this familiar.
Was an awesome cigar.
Wow.
The burn, the whole bit. I think it was a Maduro, I'm thinking. You know, it was late at night and stuff, so... but man, what an awesome cigar, and available at Havana House.
There you go.
There
That's
you go.
Where I've seen it.
Aging Room, Pura Cepa. Awesome. In fact, today I'm going over the Havana House and buy some of these.
There you go.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's my review. Could I tell you about the taste? It was very smooth. I can tell you that. Didn't leave a harsh, you know, residue in my mouth.
Yeah.
And very tasty and very relaxing. What a great, great smoke this was. So, a shout out to Rob House. Acknowledgement of Rob House.
Acknowledgements.
Who, on a Friday night, otherwise I would have come back here and not sure what I was going to do. And he said, cruise over to the house. Let's have a cigar.
So you went to Rob House's house.
Rob House's house.
Huh.
And Teresa House was in her house.
Yeah.
Teresa House was at Rob House's house.
Well,
because it's
out.
Her house, too.
Shout out to the houses at their house. Hey, you know who we don't have here with us today? Will Tapia.
Who?
Yeah, Will Tapia.
Oh, I know.
He's not here with us today on this episode.
Do you miss him?
Well, of course I miss him. I'm crying crocodile tears.
I'm happy to report that he's still working over there at Frank Frank's.
Is he?
Frank's.
Wow,
Frank's.
2 weeks in a row? This is pretty
Frank's.
This is
Frank's.
Frank's Frank's. This
Frank's,
is pretty Frank's. Epic.
That's a record.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like a record.
It's like 2 weeks.
Yeah. He must be really enjoying it. They must be enjoying him, you know,
he's got
the
on.
He's I wonder, did he move on from the relish?
Yeah,
from the relish guy.
But he's packed on a couple of pounds.
Has he? Is he eating all the Franks?
Yeah, Franks.
Yeah, it'd be a hard job if you like Franks. That'd be a temptation.
No, he'll be. But I haven't talked to William in, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days.
No, that's not been that long. It's impossible.
No, really.
I think it's not even been that long. We were with him last week.
That's right. I try to put these things out of my mind.
And then,
you know, so I'm just kidding.
We don't want to clutter your mind.
No, right. So, no, that's true. I saw him recently.
We might be able to get another podcast in this week with him if we do something in the evening.
That's right.
Because he's, you know, he's always busy doing the Franks thing.
You know who I miss?
Who's that?
Already is Brian and Marissa.
Yeah, you know, shout out to the Gutierrez family.
They've only been gone for a week. Miss them already.
I know. They went down to El Paso.
They moved to El Paso.
Uh-huh. God bless their journey. We loved having them in our parish. And
3.5 hours away.
Young couple, just a great example of coming into a parish. They'd only been with us for a couple of years, and they immediately got interested and involved.
Yep.
And I think that was kind of their MO. But, you know, you think about it, this really is the right development, I think, of a mature Christian, mature Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this before, but, you know, it's the idea that you could, that once you've been raised in the faith, as even Brian and Marisa in their young age have been, then the next goal ought to be turning around and then becoming one of the people who then feed the younger generations and who feed the poor and who visit the imprisoned.
Well,
that's
a visible sign of mature Christianity.
Right. That the Lord starts to work through us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there should be a point at which where our coming to be fed is less than, I think, less than us helping to do the feeding. Because we actually are fed by doing the feeding. I think that's what
Well, but that's true. But also the reason, the point of coming to Mass is to be fed by word and sacrament, which gives us the strength and the knowledge and all the things we need to be able to feed other people.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about just, you know, food. I'm talking about, you know, with knowledge and faith and encouragement and good things, you know, all these good things. Right. So
it's almost like a spiritual gluttony. Mm-hmm. I think that we actually get involved in. Mm-hmm. Just kind of shooting from the hip here, but that I feel like it's almost like a spiritual gluttony. Like I'm coming and I'm almost consuming more than my fair share, right? And doing what with it? Nothing, right? And this brings to mind the fact that I recently caught on to some really neat little videos done by a priest by the name of Father Chad Ripperger. And he has one on, if you just YouTube him, you'll find he has a series of videos, but he did a short video on each of the deadly sins, including actual gluttony. And they're brilliant. They're really brilliant. And it was brought to my mind from a conversation I had last night with one of our priests in the diocese, Father Michael Garcia, who's out there in Santo Domingo Pueblo. And also, who is Peña Blanca?
Peña Blanca.
And God bless him, man. These guys are like missionaries out there doing their work, holding the line. Well, anyway, so it came up in conversation. I looked up these videos all about the seven deadly sins. You know what I discovered? I'm pretty sure I'm guilty of every single one of them.
Well,
on a daily basis.
Yeah. That's probably most
on a daily basis. But it's so curious. What's fascinating is to see the, I don't know if it's hegemony of the word I want to, maybe more like genealogy of how these, what you wouldn't think leads to another actually does, you know, like, it's really fascinating just to understand how they're related and how when you fall down in one of the seven deadly sins, it leads to falling down or temptations and other deadly sins and all kind of interconnected. No wonder, you know, this has all been brilliantly worked out for so many years.
So there was it was Mary and Magdala, I believe, who Jesus drove, what, seven demonic spirits out of? Correct? Seven devils? And
yeah,
they equate that to the seven deadly sins.
I hadn't thought about that.
Right?
Brilliant.
So if Jesus, I've always thought about this, if Jesus drove out seven, you know.
Right, seven evil spirits, yeah.
How many is he going to drive out of me?
Each one of us, right? Yeah, crazy. Well, so I totally recommend a little reflection on that. And if you can find Ripperger's, Father Ripperger's stuff online, then that's a good starting place for it. Okay, so speaking of spiritual development, should we segue to the gospel?
We shall. Hey, can we real quick tell them about your plans for the next, you know?
Like, yeah, I'm going to be, you know what? I'm fixing to leave for the summer, so I'm probably not going to be around for a few of the podcasts anyway. I'm planning on heading back to the islands where I'd spent some time teaching theology on the high school level. But this time I'm going to go back out there and found a gig helping a surf school, actually, on the island of Maui. So I'll be out there playing in God's creation of the ocean, and so say a prayer for me that I remain safe and that things work out. But and then I'll of course be thinking of all of you in my absence. But that's, you know, that's mostly just because the you know, at the parish a lot of the formation activity slows down a little bit, and I saw it as an opportunity just to have a little getaway and then also be productive. And, you know, even St. Paul made tents, right? Mm-hmm. I was a tent maker, you know, as far as his day job. And so I don't see it as a separation of my activity in the church, just, you know, just another activity that to
surfing
kind of combine some of my interests. Yeah.
Surf instructor.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you go from ski instructor to surf instructor.
That's the idea. So one form of water to the next. So, you know, icy, snowy to more fluid. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see how it goes. I'm looking forward to connecting with some of the, Catholic churches out there that I'd connected with in the past. And
what island?
Like I said, and just to spend time in God's creation. I mean,
what island?
Maui.
Oh, Maui. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
My brother has a house in Kauai.
Kauai. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very
Kauai.
Cool.
And then I've been to Oahu and I've been to Molokai.
Yeah. You know, I never did make it over to Molokai to see the tomb of St. Damien. But I would like to. That's one. It's kind of on my agenda, you know, because you can get in between the islands for like $100, little plane flight, yeah. You know,
little plane, and, little plane for sure.
Yeah, and so I know there's little companies that do visits to
the tomb of.
Saint
I took
Damien.
One of those flights. It was horrific.
You don't like planes to begin with.
A 30-minute flight, and it was hell.
You're not a big fan of that, anyway. You know what I found tricky was the ferries. There's some ferries that that go between the islands.
And that must be rough.
You know, not having grown up on the ocean, I found myself having to get used to it again because it's enough to toss your cookies, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, kinda it's not wacky. Like the Long Island Ferry and right though that thing just scoots across the sound, you know, it's
yeah. No, nothing. It's
you
it's,
get on the open ocean, forget it's a different story.
It is a little bit different story. And I remember just fighting back the nausea because I was with some students from the school that I was teaching at, and I really didn't want to embarrass myself. Mm-hmm. So
okay, gospel time.
All right, let's do it.
No game show. No game show. I get lazy, man. And I got I haven't done a song in a long time.
Is it laziness or sloth?
It's sloth.
Oh, my. No, you know what happens?
I think it's come on.
You've got other things going on as a priest. You know, this is a nice addition to our activity in the church, but it's not the primary activity.
Yes, sir. Okay, here we go. This is from the third Sunday. This is the short. We're going to do the short form. Okay?
Yeah, that was the conversation over lunch with several priests and deacons not too long ago. Which form did you use, the long or the short?
The short. I did the short. Well, I did. Actually, at the 5 o'clock, I did the long version. The other masses, I did the short.
Very good. Okay. All right, let's hear it.
And the reason, like at 8 o'clock, I did because I had a baptism going on after that mass.
Yeah, you've got to be mindful.
Yeah,
you've got to be mindful of people's schedules.
Right. Okay. Here we go. At that time, Jesus revealed himself to his disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. He revealed himself in this way: together were Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, Zebedee's sons, and two other of his disciples. So Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing," and they said, "We'll come too." Okay, I'm giving you the, you know, putting my own spin on
it. Okay, you're doing your own translation.
Yeah.
It's a dynamic translation.
Yeah, I get it. We'll come too. Actually, it's we also will come with you. So I put my own little twist. Did you see that?
Uh-huh.
See how I did that? Okay. We'll come too. Okay, so they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. When it was already dawn, Jesus was standing on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, "Children, have you caught anything to eat?" And they answered him, "No." So he said to them, "Cast the net over the right side of the boat and you will find something." That's got to be significant somehow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so they cast it and were not able to pull it in because of the number of fish. So the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." And when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he tucked in his garment, for he was lightly clad, and jumped into the sea. And the other disciples came in the boat, for they were not far from shore, only about 100 yards, dragging the net of fish. When they climbed out into the shore, onto the shore, they saw a charcoal fire with fish on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you just caught." And so Simon Peter went over and dragged the net ashore full of 153 large fish. That too has to be significant somehow, I'm guessing, right? Mm. That number, maybe?
Yeah, I would think.
Yeah, even though, why would he bring it up, you know? I mean, why not just say, you know, the mess of fish, right? Even though there were so many, the net was not torn. So Jesus said to them, "Come, have breakfast." And none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" Because they realized that it was the Lord. And Jesus came over and took the bread, gave it to them, and in a like manner, the fish. This was now the third time Jesus was revealed to his disciples after being raised from the dead.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, here they are fishing. And
not just a wishing, but going fishing.
Not just a wishing, but fishing. And of course, this is chronologically, this would be after the resurrection, right?
Third time.
And
third time after the resurrection, third appearance, it tells us, right?
Right.
And it's funny, it's on the third Sunday of Easter. You see how they did that, right? Third appearance, third Sunday.
That is interesting how they broke up those. I'm just looking through the text. This is the reason for my silence. And immediately at the beginning, well, first of all, it says that he went to the Sea of Tiberias, and then, and which I think is partly significant too. And I was just thinking, I was just looking at the Navarre Bible Commentary to find out to find out a little more information. It says that this is partly to fulfill the command that Jesus had given them in Matthew 28. But moving on, here we have Thomas called Didymus. He's, of course, a twin. Mm-hmm. This is why the term Didymus is being used, Greek word for twin. Mm-hmm. And they're all gathered up, and they're all out fishing, which what do you think is the significance of that, first of all? Like, does it mean that they simply have gone back to their earthly way of life?
I think so. I think it does. Well, they got to make a living.
Yeah.
And they kept doing for quite a while the jobs that they used to do because they had to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. I mean, this brings to mind a phrase that I remember someone in the church telling me once, and it goes something like, you can't be so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good. Mm-hmm. And so it does call to mind even the admonitions that St. Paul made in the New Testament. And I forget, I think it was to the Thessalonians. I could be wrong, but he basically says, all of you are standing around waiting for the Lord's return. But, you know, if it's not happening right this second, then you're just wasting time. Mm-hmm. You're not being practically useful to your families, to yourselves, right, to society. So it's important to have a balance, it seems, between what we do, you know, in an earthly sense and what we do for the Lord. And so we ought to see them as not contrary to one another, but as integrated with one another. Kind of like going back to what we were saying about the integration of the body and the soul earlier.
Correct. But also, you know, it's important that, we have to work, and work is good. Labor is good, and the idea of us being disciples is to take our faith into the workplace.
Right. Right.
So I would imagine that those guys, while they were fishing, what do you suppose they were talking about? What were they sharing with each other?
Hmm.
Their experience of the resurrection.
Yeah, you would have to think.
Right?
Right.
So it's not like they just suspended, okay, we'll think about this later. Right now we've got fish to catch.
Mm-hmm.
So they went, and because they had to make a living, they had to... You know, they had jobs, and that was to be fishermen, these guys.
Right. So, and no wonder the Lord then continues, like, consistently uses this metaphor.
Right.
Dare we say, metaphor. Of them being fishers of men, right?
Right.
And so he doesn't waste anything. Insofar as they've gone back out now and they're fishing, actually fishing, this could be just setting in more and more the Lord in his teaching of their hearts, setting into their hearts this idea which will be expounded upon and kind of like, I don't know, put on steroids, we might say, when they're being forced out then into the mm-hmm. preaching phase of their lives, wherein they start to travel and plant churches mm-hmm. and then ultimately receive what I would call the gift of martyrdom, right?
Right.
The Lord calls them to be fishers of men. And of course, he knows he's got some real fishermen here, because it seems like every time you turn around, that's what they're doing. And maybe rightfully so, because it's, you know, part of their profession. Mm-hmm. Now, why then? Okay, so they look out onto the shore and they don't recognize at first. Again, there's that whole disconnect between, you know, even after they've seen him once, right? You just mentioned this is a third sighting. They still don't recognize him. Is it because they just don't expect him to keep appearing to them? Or what do you think is going on with that?
Weren't they in the boat still? And he was...
Yeah, it was a bit... I think it says he was a long way off.
Okay, so they didn't recognize him probably because he was a long way off. That's my guess. Unless he changed his appearance somehow, you know?
Right.
So that's a good question. My answer to that would be that, yeah, he was still a long distance. When they drew close enough to him, then they recognized him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, I know. We know who this is.
Right.
That would be my guess.
And of course, there's that opportunity for him, right, disguised mode to tell them, right, to give them a chance for faith. Because he tells them, cast the net mm-hmm. over the side of the boat, right? If you're not catching anything, mm-hmm. and that's what they said they were not. And so he tells them, cast the net over the side of the boat, and they do, and they bring in all this fish.
But didn't that should have jogged their memory to before when they were in the, remember when they were, when he was with them?
Yeah.
Did you catch nothing? Okay. And then, so cast your nets on Peter, go back out. And then Peter's like, what? Okay. If you say so, I will. And I don't know where that's, found in the gospel, but it's there, right? Yeah. So when this happened, when the person on the shore said, pull back out and throw your nets on the right side, that should have said, whoa.
Yeah, immediately. And I think it did strike a chord, because then in the telling of the gospel, then it says that, so they did cast the net and were not able to pull it in because of the number of fish. So the disciple whom Jesus loved, John, said to Peter, it is the Lord. Like, he's the one who put it all together in the first, you know, at first. And of course, maybe, I don't know, I'm assuming he wrote this gospel. I don't know if he was tooting his own horn or what, he says, you know, he basically is the one that put it together first. And then when Simon Peter understood it, right, upon John's witness, and him, maybe it sunk into his brain, oh yeah, yeah, absolutely, that absolutely is the Lord. Then he jumped into the sea, it says, you know, very, Peter's this very like spontaneous, you know, guy. He's doing things like, you know, defending the Lord at one point, then another point he's denying the Lord, and then he's back to defending the Lord, and then he's kind of like this back and forth, very mercurial, you know, type of personality. But I think that's why he's so loved by the Lord, such to even become the first pope, is, you know, he's a very normal guy in that regard. So then he very spontaneously jumps into the water and swims over to the shore.
Mm-hmm. But you mentioned John just now about how he makes the connection. It was John. If you've noticed in the Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was John who, okay, they show the scene. They kept having flashbacks to the Last Supper when Jesus is being crucified.
Yeah.
So so John is there, and the cross raises up, and then they have a flashback to Jesus lifting up the loaf of bread, which of course is the Eucharist, correct?
Mm.
And then there's they show the blood coming down, and then Jesus lifts up the chalice, and then there the camera goes back to John the apostle, and you can just see it in the eye. And the actor did a great job of this. You can see it in the eye that that John was making this connection now. So John and Gibson picked up on that. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
How Gibson picked up on that. And you can see John making the connection between the sacrifice of Christ on the cross and the sacrifice of the Mass.
Right.
Right. Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful.
That film really did, I think, displayed or portrayed cinematically. Right. So many of these beautiful correlations.
And perhaps Gibson was studying this, you know, because there's John who's going, hey, wait a second, you know, and then hearkening back to that episode when they were fishing and, you know, they caught nothing. And Jesus said, go back out, right, and do this. And now this person on the shore who's too far off to see says this to them. And same thing happens. They pull in so many fish that John makes the connection and says, it's the Lord. Who else is it? Who else would it be? That's the Lord, right? So then, and then Peter gets excited, of course, and then and jumps into the water, and we know the rest, right? So, yeah, it's just an amazing, the whole, you know, everything about all the post-resurrection event, you know, accounts are just so fascinating and just filled with so much good, you know, and you know, it just makes you wonder, you know, if our Lord was to appear to us this very day, you know, would we recognize him?
Hmm.
You know, would we recognize him? You know what I mean? Yeah. And how would we recognize him?
Hmm.
You know what I mean? How would we recognize him?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Ever think about that?
No, absolutely. And I think it makes me think about, you know, what I want to have happen on my judgment day. Whether I want that judgment today to be, you know, not having seen the Lord in forever because of my separation from him, let's say, in this lifetime. And then judgment day comes and now I'm standing in front of, the proverbial stranger, you know, who I at least at one time had called Lord. And I can imagine that would be a very awkward situation as opposed to the situation I would desire in my heart, which is to arrive at judgment day and let it be just like any other day. Mm-hmm. Where it's like,
right?
Hello, Lord. Hello again.
Like exactly.
You know what I mean? In other words, such that I spend so much time with him in my heart, in my soul, that that any meeting with the Lord is a familiar one. And that, like you just pointed to with the reference to Gibson's movie, I think can be accomplished by just spending time with him. How do we spend time with him? Well, besides prayer and reading the Word of God, it's also mm-hmm. to spend time in front of the Holy Eucharist, whether mm-hmm. it be at Mass, in adoration, just sitting in the church with the tabernacle. That's time spent with the Lord, creating that familiarity that we all want to have.
I would say that we who believe, we who have faith, would recognize him. And we are told that the sheep know his voice and they follow it. So we would know his voice. We would know him, okay, because we sheep know him. And we know him because of, you know, our prayer life, being followers already, having a prayer life and you know, seeing him in the sacraments, through the sacraments, right? Mm. And through adoration and all of that, we would recognize him, you know? And we, again, would know his voice.
Right.
You know, and so we would, which, by the way, leads me to consider, you know, and I find it just sobering that I don't know where it is in scripture, but I do not. What is it? The about the evildoers and the Lord saying to them at the end, go away from me. I do not know you.
I do not even know you. Yeah. You will say, Lord, Lord. And I will say, I don't even know you.
I don't even know you. Yeah. Because you do not know me.
Mm-hmm.
And my followers know me because they know my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we who are faithful and, you know, we're not perfect, obviously, but doing our best. Right. I think we would recognize him.
Yeah. I think that's the danger of a relationship that gets separated from the Lord, is that then you're not able to produce that familiarity right. that you would want to have now and forever, let alone on your judgment day.
Right.
Now, it says that I think it makes us, by the way, little side note. I was just looking in the Devar commentary of John chapter 21, and it was saying that St. Thomas comments that the number of fish, that 153, symbolizes the number of the elect. Now, it's a symbol, right? Yeah. A symbolic number. I can't imagine that it refers exactly to 153 elect per se, but perhaps a symbolic number. You know, numerology was quite the thing, especially in Jewish tradition. And so, you know, and then you can do some research online with Catholic sites about the significance of the numbers that we encounter in Scripture mm-hmm. and in our faith. But all that aside, I wanted to ask you, Father, what do you think is the significance of Jesus making a meal for them and eating with them?
Well, as I mentioned in an earlier podcast, number one, to prove to them that he was not a ghost and that he's real,
because mm-hmm.
ghosts don't eat. But the fact that he feeds them.
Hmm.
You know, it's just like, okay, so we could go back to when Jesus worked the miracle of the multiplying of the loaves and fishes.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus worked the miracle.
Right.
But it's interesting. He then, after doing so, he said to his disciples, feed the people.
Right.
Okay. And then in the longer version of this text that I just read,
mm-hmm.
so Jesus feeds the disciples, he cooked, he had a charcoal fire going for them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then he fed them the bread. There was the bread and the fish, which they brought. Okay, and then he cooked it up, and then he said, eat. Let's all eat, right? So Jesus feeds them, but then it's interesting, in the long text after this is the conversation, and this is something we didn't read, and this is the conversation between Jesus and Peter, where Jesus asked the question, Peter, do you love me? Yeah, Lord, you know I do.
Mm.
Feed my sheep.
Mm.
Feed my people. Feed my sheep.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting?
Incredible.
I have fed you. Now you feed them.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a significant, because it was a threefold denial of Christ that Peter made.
Well, right. So it's a reversal of the threefold denial.
Hmm.
But what I'm pointing out is the fact that Jesus feeds them all, and then he pulls Peter aside and asks this question, and then tells Peter, there's several ways we can go with this. Number one, it shows that Jesus, again, as he has done many times before, singles out Peter for a special mission. Right?
Right.
So that's the one thing.
Mm-hmm.
He singles Peter out.
Yeah.
Okay. He didn't say that to all the disciples. Hey, everybody, do you love me? And they all answered, oh, yeah, we love you. Then feed my people. He singles out Peter to show that there's something special about him.
Right.
Okay. Yep. But the fact that, okay, so Jesus fed the guys, Peter being one of them. Okay. And then he's saying to Peter, now you feed the people. And I would go back to, you know, the fact that, look, we can't feed each other. We can't feed other people if we ourselves are not fed. We can't give somebody what we don't have to give them. Okay, so if we're going to feed people the truth and goodness and and generosity and whatever else, you know, the word of God, whatever, the sacraments, whatever, we have to be first fed ourselves. The Lord wants to feed us and to empower us, therefore, by what he has fed us, so then we can feed the people in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're not being fed, then we can't do that.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you make a good point.
Yeah.
We allow the Lord to feed us so that we can feed his people, just like you said,
mm-hmm.
How incredibly important it is. And then of course, you know, demands that we remain close to him,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you see it in the church. Just because someone is involved in ministry or mm-hmm. involved in the Christian way of life doesn't mean that they stay closely connected to the Lord. And you can tell when mm-hmm. that disconnect happens.
But to me, it's especially true for parents, especially yeah. dads.
Okay. How so do you mean?
Well, if dad's not practicing his faith, and how's he going to feed his kids?
Hmm.
And it's a grave sin not to lead your children in think about it. A parent's role is to raise their children, to give them knowledge and to give them all these good things. You know, the greatest thing you can give your kid is faith and heaven.
Right.
So to neglect that is one priest friend of mine says that's the greatest kind of neglect.
Hmm.
Okay, so, well, if dad and mom are not going to getting fed and filled,
mm-hmm.
how are they going to feed their kids the truth, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
it kind of goes back to what we were saying. You know, it's a little bit of a harkening back to those seven deadly sins. I think it falls into the sin of sloth, mm-hmm. spirit, which is a spiritual sloth, right, that we become complacent in our duties, in our spiritual duties. And
which comes from pride. All the sins come from pride, that one sin of pride.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to do it. I can't do it.
Right.
I don't feel like doing it.
Yeah.
I've got something better to do for me. Yeah. For me, I, right?
Mm, Yeah, for sure. those are good words to hear, even as we speak them, for the sake of our own souls. And so the Lord does us a favor, I think, by what he did with the apostles and allowing us to reflect on it, such that our lives can be better too.
Mm-hmm. So true. Okay. Well, great discussion, dude.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So we are going to attempt before Tony leaves to Hawaii. I'm jealous. I'm just
letting me... Well, you can come visit me.
Yeah. It's really not that.
I'll see about you. Really bring your golf clubs.
I know.
Dude. And the flights, there's extra flights now going there.
Two flights from
Southwest, you know, has opened up some new routes.
So dude, it's here to LA, which is 2 hours, and then 5 hours from LA to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Simple.
It's still you can still grab. So I am going to actually fly to Kauai first and then to Maui, but you can still find, even this week, you can find one way to Kauai under $300.
Yeah.
So multiply that by two, that's you're still under $600 round trip.
Of course, when you get there, a hotel room is going to cost you $750.
Well, I plan on staying in maybe more of a hostel, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful place, though, man. Tell you.
Yeah. And you can sleep on the beach, too.
Well, yeah.
Not legally, but not legally.
No, but some people do.
Yeah. Well, there are people who do it, but you're not supposed to. It's supposed to be, it's an interesting, this is very tangential, but, you know, all of the beaches, mm-hmm. Are public. There's no such thing as a private beach there, mm-hmm. which I think is beautiful because that means mm-hmm. everybody can partake of it. But then at nighttime you have to, the only way you can actually be on a beach at night, supposedly like if the cops come or something, is you have to be Hawaiian mm-hmm. and you have to be fishing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Or a turtle.
Or maybe a turtle.
Yeah, be a turtle.
Sea lion.
Or some, creature.
Which
like
I might occasionally be mistaken for, depending. Yeah. No, so before I take off and go try out my adventure in Hawaii, what's going to happen?
Well, we're going to attempt a podcast.
That'd be great. We should do it.
Yeah, because you're going to be gone for I don't know.
A couple months.
Just
a couple months. It's the summer months, you know?
You know, and then I have to put up with that dude. You
you'll have to be doing these things with Mr. Will.
Frank's. Yeah, okay, absolutely. So, go if you're a Facebook, or not a Facebook guy, but a...
social media.
Well, an iPod guy.
Instagram.
iTunes.
iPad.
iTunes, iPod, iPad.
Face.
Whatever happened to Space? Was there a Facebook at one time?
MySpace.
MySpace, Facebook, Spacehead,
Space Rockets. Man.
So if you're an iTunes dude or a gal, you can go in there. We like reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that would be good. Okay, and then there's this other stuff with Snapchat. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I don't know where else we
I'm
are.
I'm an old
we're on
man.
Google, we're on Google Play and
I'm
iTunes.
I'm an old man.
And
of I don't course, know these things.
We're on the internet, the website, sjbnm.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll be talking to you soon. Next week.
Yep.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.